in Rhode Island. At the desk, she slit the envelope open and found two close-written sheets. Dear Dr. Savard, I write to you because Detective Sergeant Maroney gave me your address and asked me to send word about how we are getting on. Henry and Montgomery and me got here by steamer with no fuss at all, clear skies and calm seas, and found a Mr. Knowles who took us and our bags and boxes in his wagon to the house and wouldn't take a nickel for his trouble. The boys, Hannes, Marcus, Wiese, Gunther, as we call them now, and they call us Oma and Opa, were just sitting down to supper made for them by Mrs. Barnes, whose husband sold us the house. There was such a great excitement in the kitchen, Henry with tears rolling down his stubbly cheeks for joy, and Montgomery leaping into the air like a rubber ball, and the boys all pressing together against us like they'd never let go. They were terribly upset to hear about their ma'am, which is why I took so long to write this letter. It hit Hannes the hardest, but he is slowly coming back to himself. Today he took the baby on his lap and played with him and made him laugh. It does a body good to hear a baby laugh like that from deep in the belly. Last night, Marcus and Wiese both slept through the night for the first time since we brought the sad news with us from home. Henry is enjoying the fine weather and the sea just as much as the boys do. You will recall that he is fond of fish, and that he has already got into the habit of walking down to the bay when the fishermen come in to buy something for supper. He takes a dollar with him, and is pleased to bring back change. I count myself very lucky. We needn't fear sickness, for there is a good doctor and an apothecary in town, and we can pay them. Hannes will start at the little school in the village in the fall with new shoes and a primer and whatever else children need these days. The boys are my life's work now, and I intend to do it proper. Good food and fresh air and a bit of work around the place for each of them, excepting the baby, of course, and a hug and kiss at bedtime, the way their ma'am would want. If Henry was clear in his mind, he would write himself to thank you and say how much we appreciate the kindness you all showed us in our hour of need. There are good people in the world, after all. We pray every day for our dearest girl. Gone forever, but never forgot. Yours truly, May Steinmauer. Anna tried to remember the last time there had been a mention in the papers about the Campbell boys, but could not. It was as if they had used up their portion of the public's interest and concern, and would not get any more attention unless they earned it. In a city where thousands of children lived on the streets, that would be hard to do. On the desk in front of her, she had the draft of a letter she had been meaning to finish and mail since the fruitless meeting with Father McKinnaway. She had revised it multiple times, and had yet to copy it in its final form onto her personal stationery. Mr. and Mrs. Amon Mullen, Tottenville, Staten Island, New York. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Mullen, I am Anna Savard Mezzanotte of New York City. On May 26th, my husband and I met your family very briefly on the beach near Mount Loretto. Your daughter, Teresa Ann, introduced us to you and her baby brother, you may recall. We hope you might be willing to grant a favor. May we stop by and visit with you one Saturday or Sunday afternoon at your convenience? This has to do with a family connection, one I would prefer not to spell out in a letter. I realize this sounds very mysterious, but let me assure you that our designs are friendly, and we mean you only well. In all probability, we will visit for less than an hour. Of course, you may well want to check references before you reply to this letter. I provide the following information to that end. I am physician and surgeon, a graduate of the Women's Medical School here in New York, and registered at sanitary headquarters as required by law. I am on staff at the New Amsterdam Charity Hospital. My husband, Detective Sergeant Giancarlo Mezzanotte, is on the New York City Police Force and is stationed at police headquarters on Mulberry Street. We live at number 18 Waverly Place. With very best wishes to you and your family, I am most sincerely yours, Dr. Anna Savard. She knew she needed to show the letter to Aunt Quinlan and Jack, and maybe even Conrad Belmont, and take advice before sending it. Anna asked herself what these people might say, if they would disapprove. With considerable effort, she tried to clear her mind and read the letter as Mrs. Mullen might read it. Would she be affronted, afraid, insulted, or simply curious? The only thing Anna knew for certain was that the situation had to be addressed soon. She sat for a moment, looking at a blank sheet of stationery. Engraved across the top in an elegant typeface was her full name, Dr. Liliane Mathilde Savard, a graduate present from Margaret. Anna had thanked her and then put the box away, only to find that she did have a use for stationery like this. It put a certain distance between herself and the person she was writing to. A private individual requesting a consultation, a colleague asking her to read the draft of a journal article, invitations to conferences and meetings, a request for a contribution to an educational fund. In each case, she had to balance interest and concern with the demands on her time and energy. The house was dim and cool and very quiet. Before she could change her mind, she got out a pen and ink and a fresh sheet of stationery. In a fluid hand, she copied out the final version of the letter to the Mullins. While the ink dried, she addressed an envelope. She folded the letter neatly, went over the creases with the letter opener, put it in the envelope, and set it aside. Then she started another, far more pleasant letter, one that would cheer up both Sophie and Cap. This letter she wanted to write. A letter with answers instead of questions. She thought of them sitting on a terrace overlooking mountains and pastures, and she wrote down for them the rest of Janine Campbell's story. She didn't realize it, Elise was sure. But with a simple statement, Anna had handed her what felt like keys to a vast kingdom. There are books and journals enough in the house, she had said. You're free to take any of them to your room. You can start studying now, and you'll be that much more prepared when classes start. The idea of going to medical school still struck Elise as alternately ridiculous and overwhelming, but it was now a fact. She carried the acceptance letter with its offer of a scholarship on her person, folded small and tucked into the waistband of her uniform skirt, as if it were a ticket that once lost could never be replaced. She began writing longer passages in her day book, listing questions that had occurred to her while with one patient or another, and now she had the books that would make it possible to start. Early Monday, a surgery was scheduled that she was now determined to watch. As a nurse, she had no claim on a spot in the gallery, but as a new medical student, she could at least try, along with every other doctor and medical student in the city in this case. Dr. Shifra Rosenmeier would begin with an orotracheal intubation and then move on to resecting 6-year-old Regina Sartori's retropharyngeal tumor. With surgery, the little girl's chances of survival were poor. Without surgery, she would be dead in weeks, if not days. But she would have a chance. Elise gathered a pile of books and sat down on the floor to begin sorting out everything there was to know about the operation to come. At 9, she got up to light the lamps and give her eyes a rest. The windows were open to the night breezes and city noises. Slowly, she was learning how to ignore the most common ones. Iron wheels on steel tracks, hoofs on pavement, the huff of steam engines, the shouts of the boys playing stickball or craps in a nearby alley. She had wondered at first how children got any sleep at all, but Rosa and Leah rarely sat still, and by bedtime they never lasted long. When they begged for bedtime stories, it was quite safe to agree to a chapter or three. To Elise's certain knowledge, they had yet to get past the first chapter of Little Women. She was almost alone in the house. The little girls asleep, the older ladies sitting in the garden pergola watching fireflies and slapping at mosquitoes. Chiara had gone to spend the night with Celestina to work on some embroidery project that was giving her fits, and Laura Lee went home every day once supper was on the table. In the daytime, the house was usually overrun with busy people. The exception was Mrs. Quinlan, who spent a good part of the morning in her little study. Mrs. Lee gladly played the dragon before the moat. Chiara swore that even the quietest footsteps passing Mrs. Quinlan's door would cause Mrs. Lee to appear with a wooden spoon that she tapped into an open palm. But then, Chiara was very fond of a good story, and believed that facts were there to be bent to the needs of the storyteller. Elise decided she was thirsty enough to go in search of the cold mint tea Mrs. Lee made by the bucketful. Maybe she would sit in the garden for a little while, if the mosquitoes weren't too bloodthirsty. She opened her door and stepped into the hallway, where she found Rosa poised for flight, her face pale with shock. She wore a clean pinafore over a muslin dress and her sturdiest shoes. There was a shawl folded over her arm, half hiding a small basket. In such a situation, Elise would have expected flustered excuses and a quick retreat back into her room. But Rosa stood there without flinching. She said,
"If you stop me now, I'll go another time. You can't watch me forever."
Confused, alarmed, Elise came closer and crouched down until their faces were on the same level.
"But where is it you're going?"
Relief flowed through the little girl, as visible as a storm tide dying out on a beach.
"To Staten Island," she said with a note of impatience, "to get my little brother. Would you come with me?"
"Sit here with me a minute." Elise tugged her to the staircase where they sat side by side, speaking in low whispers.
"Why do you think your brother, Vittorio," Rosa supplied, "the baby, why do you think he's on Staten Island?"
From the basket, Rosa took a single sheet of paper and held it out. Anna's handwriting, with much crossing out and many insertions. The letter had not come easily to her. Rather than take it in hand, Elise said,
"Tell me what it says."
Rosa bit her lips so hard that Elise expected to see blood.
"I have to go now before they come in from the garden. Won't you come with me?"
"Wait,"
Elise said.
"No,"
Rosa said, getting up.
"I'm not going to wait anymore. Rosa, you can't stop me. It's your fault that he got lost in the first place. You lost him, and now they know where he is, but they aren't doing anything about it. Well, I'll do something."
She began to run down the stairs.
"Rosa,"
Elise said, trying to keep her voice calm,
"there's no ferry at this time of night. You can't get to Staten Island until morning."
Which might not be strictly true, but she had nothing else to offer. The girl paused to look over her shoulder. Elise had never seen such an expression on a child's face. Misery and anger and flint-hard determination.
"I'll hide until morning," she said. "I've done it before."
Elise saw Jack coming out of the hall from the kitchen. Rosa followed her shifting gaze, and then she was dashing for the door. Before she could even turn the lock, he was there. Rosa screamed, a scream that would tear a hard man's heart in two, and Jack was not hard of heart. He picked up a kicking Rosa and held her while she screamed and thrashed. He simply kept her against his chest, in the circle of his arms. Jack was talking to her, a low river of sound. When she tried to bite him, he adjusted his grip and kept talking. When Mrs. Quinlan and Mrs. Cooper came rushing into the hall, he kept talking. Rosa was still howling, her mouth a dark hole. She ripped the buttons from Jack's shirt collar and threw them. her other fist hitting him on the jaw, the cheek, the ear. He never flinched, and he never stopped murmuring to her. Now she was shouting at him, directing all her anger and frustration into his face in a rushing, tumbling stream of Italian. By his expression, it was clear Jack understood her. A kind of calm came over him and seemed to pass into Rosa, who slumped against his shoulder. A door opened behind Elise. Leah came into the light, sleep-tousled, her thumb firmly in her mouth, and tears pouring down her face in a sheet.
"Oh, baby," Elise said, "come here."
She pulled the little girl close and folded her into her lap, smoothing her hair.
"Shall we go into my room and get into the big bed?"
Leah wound her free hand in Elise's shirt waist so tightly that she felt the pull of it at her throat.
"Shall we?"
Her head jerked from side to side. "No."
"It will be all right," Elise whispered to her. "I know this is scary, but it will be all right. We'll all sit down together and find a way to make Rosa feel better. We can do that, Leah."
She realized then that Mrs. Cooper had come up the stairs and stood motionless, her hands flat on her waist, arms akimbo. Leah's eyes, brimming with tears, blinked once, and then she held her arms out. Elise had had more than one uncharitable thought about Margaret Cooper, and she was embarrassed to remember how quickly she had judged. Her whole person, body and mind, belonged to Leah, who had wrapped her arms and legs around Mrs. Cooper's neck and slender waist. She murmured to the little girl, soft sounds that might have been words, but were meant for no one in the world but Leah. When the door to the girl's room closed behind them, Elise had to put her forehead down on her knees and let herself be swept away, just in that moment, home to her own mother. Rosa was still talking in ragged bursts. Jack held her safely in his arms, listening. In small, easy steps, he moved into the parlor. Mrs. Quinlan gestured for Elise. She had an errand and didn't want to wake Mr. Lee. Would Elise be so good?
"Of course. Just tell me what I can do."
She pressed money into Elise's hand and closed her fingers over the bills. "Walk over to the New York Hotel front entrance. Tell Mr. Manchester I've sent you. He'll get you a cab. Let him get the cab for you, do you hear me? Then go straight to the New Amsterdam and tell Anna what has happened here. Ask her to come home as soon as she's able." All the questions tumbling through her head, but only one presented itself.
"What now?"
Mrs. Quinlan was very old, but there was nothing frail about her. She was filled with calm determination that settled Elise's own jangling nerves. Some women had that strength hidden inside them, a light that flared to life when everyone else was overwhelmed. She patted Elise's cheek and smiled at her, a weary but fond smile. "Tomorrow, Anna and Jack will take the girls to Staten Island to see their brother Vittorio," she said. "Nothing else will do." Chapter 37. The rainy day that Anna had wished for came, and would be not wished away again. All the way to the ferry terminal, she worried that their departure would be suspended due to rough waters. At the last moment, the winds died back, and they were allowed to board. In the hurry not to miss the ferry, she had forgotten things. She hadn't checked to see if the girls had handkerchiefs, or how much money she had in her pocketbook, or if her hat was pinned firmly in place. A gust of wind made her think of the pins, because it almost took the hat from her head. At the same time, it took the only umbrella she had found in the rush and turned it inside out with a great pop. But they got onto the ferry, and it left as scheduled to plow its way through the chop. Anna held Leah's head while she was sick, both of them soaked by rain that was falling so hard that each drop bounced like a grasshopper off rail and deck. Leah's complexion went a sickly yellow-green. The only reasonable, sensible thing to do was to turn around and go home. But one look in Rosa's direction made it clear that she would fight such a suggestion with all the strength she could muster. Anna carried Leah back into the cabin and settled with her on a wooden bench across from Jack, who had already accumulated a small pond around himself. On another day, she would have had to laugh. He would have laughed at himself. But for Rosa, who sat a little apart, her body angled away from them. She answered Jack in monosyllables when he asked a question. But she would not even look in Anna's direction. She was in shock. Anna understood that and lectured herself. Any attempt to explain or justify would only make things worse. She tried to work out what she might say. A priest found Vittorio at the Foundling and gave him to a Catholic family to raise as their own. Now he's Timothy Mullen, and the law will do nothing to restore him to his sisters. Or she could leave the church out of it. He is a healthy, happy child, one who is very much loved, and who loves. Timothy Mullen clings to his adoptive mother because he remembers no other. Rosa was not interested in logic or reason or the law. All attempts to engage her met with a blank look. She was as brittle and unreachable as a stroke victim. The rain fell all the way across Raritan Bay and was still falling when they left the ferry and walked the short distance to the railway station, where stranded travelers were packed, all wet and cold and not inclined to see the situation as anything but inexcusable. But a tree had fallen across the tracks, and it would be at least an hour, probably two, until anybody went anywhere. Leah was a sodden bundle of miserable little girl in her arms. She needed to be stripped out of the wet clothes and rubbed down. But for the moment, any small distraction might help. Anna wiggled her way through the muttering discontents to get to a window made opaque by condensation. With her gloved hand, she wiped it clean and began to point things out. A yellow dinghy tugging at its ropes like a restless dog. A runaway hat tumbling over and over in the gusting wind. A flash of lightning in the distance. A lady who stood in the doorway of the bakery, peeking out from under her umbrella, watching for someone who was clearly late. "Who do you think she's waiting for?" Anna asked. It was a game Leah loved, the making up of stories. But there was nothing there today, not the least spark. Jack and Rosa had come to stand behind them. Or Jack had come, leading Rosa by the hand. He was talking to Rosa, but Leah was listening. On so little sleep, Anna's mind would have nothing to do with Italian. And so she waited while Jack talked and the girls asked questions. When Rosa's shoulders slumped, Anna knew that he had made the situation clear to her. The only way to Tottenville was by train. Trains ran on tracks, tracks were sometimes made impassable by the weather, and the weather was out of everyone's control. They were all of them wet and hungry, Jack was telling them. But there was a hotel just down the street. One small good thing struck Anna once they were out in the weather. Stapleton was a wealthy town, so that the roads were paved and the sidewalks raised. They would not have to slog through the mud. The Stapleton Arms lobby smelled of wet wool and coal oil and sweat. Within a minute, Anna decided that she would rather be wet outside than steaming hot in a crowded lobby. Jack paid a premium for two rooms, while Anna talked to the matron about towels, cocoa and buttered toast, tea and sandwiches. The matron went bustling off, and Anna hoped the rest of the staff was as sharp and quick. Finally in the room, she decided she could forgive the hotel owner for overheating the lobby. It was a very pleasant room with an attached bath. Anna wondered briefly how much Jack had had to pay. A small table, a comfortable chair, and a good-sized bed with clean linen and a pretty quilt. As the first order of business, she cracked both windows for fresh air. She had barely taken off her hat when they were invaded by the matron, leading her maids like soldiers into battle. There were stacks of towels and loaded trays, dry socks and face cloths. Jack took a few towels for himself and disappeared into the next room, while Anna began stripping wet clothes off Leah. The matron did the same for Rosa, who allowed this service without comment. The food was set out on the table, and then the maids ducked their heads and withdrew. Leah, wrapped in towels, managed a smile for the matron, who brought her a cup of cocoa. Rosa accepted a cup too, and soon began to blink sleepily. They had another hour to wait, and a nap seemed the best use of that time. The matron, Mrs. Singer, as it turned out, had brought a dressing gown for Anna to use, old and frayed at the hem, but sweet-smelling. Anna went behind the privacy screen to strip and handed her clothes over to Mrs. Singer.
"I'll hang all your things in the kitchen where it's warmest."
"I don't know what you can do to make them dry in an hour," Anna said, "but thank you for trying." Mrs. Singer raised one thin eyebrow.
"If the next train leaves before 3, I'll eat my own hat and yours for good measure. It always takes longer than they claim."
The matron went out as Jack came in. Rosa said,
"Where did you get that?"
"It's pink," Leah said and giggled.
"These girls are mocking me, Anna. Mocking me."
"You're wearing a pink dressing gown," Leah pointed out. "You look silly."
It was true. The old dressing gown the landlord had found for him was big enough, but it had faded over the years from what had probably been a somber maroon to a delicate pink. "And you have cocoa all around your mouth like a mustache and beard. Let's get you cleaned up and down for a nap."
Anna's stomach gave a terrific growl, and so she sat down to eat while Jack folded back the covers. Both girls were asleep before he had finished tucking them in. Anna, her hair still dripping, sat in the chair beside the bed and went about the business of putting herself in order, when she would have liked nothing more than to climb into bed with them. Jack came up behind her with a fresh towel.
"Here," he said, "let me."
While he pressed water from her hair, she closed her eyes and let herself be drawn down and down into the comfort of it. Then he ruined her lovely half-sleep.
"Listen now, while I talk. No arguments, just listen."
Anna drew in a deep breath and let it go in one long sigh. She got up from the chair and went to the window, but he followed her.
Jack said, "Nobody in this world could have done more for these girls than you have. Rosa doesn't see that now, but she will. You have to remember that and leave guilt and remorse behind, because while it seems as though she's ignoring you, she's watching every move you make."
Anna nodded and yawned, and, leaning forward to put her head on Jack's unyielding shoulder, she fell asleep. The sun broke through the last of the clouds just as they reached the railroad office, and that, Jack decided, could be taken as a good omen. From there, things moved quickly. Tickets were bought, and all four of them settled on the crowded train, while a faint rainbow appeared over Raritan Bay. Anna sat across the aisle with Leah, who was taking in the scenery with something like astonishment. After Washington Square's walkways and benches and neatly manicured bushes and trees, Staten Island would be overwhelming. Once or twice, he had heard Aunt Quinlan telling stories of her childhood in the endless forests and mountains of northernmost New York State. And so it came as no surprise when Leah asked about bears and panthers, wolves and moose. "Not here," Anna told her. "The endless forests are far away. It's a long journey."
Beaver? Leah asked hopefully. There must be beaver.
Anna raised a shoulder. I don't know. Maybe the conductor could tell you. See, he's coming now to take our tickets. You had to admire Anna's way of dealing with the girls. Rather than try to convince them they should not be sad or angry or disappointed in something, she gave them something else to concentrate on. He had seen this strategy work dozens of times already, as it worked now. Leah tugged on the conductor's sleeve to ask a question, and for the rest of the journey she looked forward to his trips through the car, when he would stop and tell her about Staten Island when he was a boy, about plentiful beaver and deer, porcupines and foxes. Rosa was listening, but she took no part in the conversation. Jack tried to imagine what she would be feeling, the relief of knowing her brother was alive and well, the fear that she would be turned away and not allowed to see him. She was angry at everyone and everything, but she focused most of that anger on Anna and Elise. It's understandable, Anna had said to him last night. She trusts me not to reject her for being angry. If I could be dispassionate about any of it, I might say that she is thinking of me like a mother, someone who will take the worst she has to offer and never turn away. Drifting between consciousness and sleep, he had thought about this Anna, who had once lost a brother. She understood Rosa's sorrow and anger better than he ever could. In Tottenville, they wasted no time wandering through the village or finding a meal, but went straight to Mr. Malone. The old man's face broke into a wide smile at the sight of them, but this time he didn't try to communicate. Instead, he picked up a short rod and struck a bell that hung over his head. Before Jack could make sense of it, Mr. Malone's son stuck his head out of a workroom of some kind, his hands full of tack. On my way! Anna looked at Jack with something like bemused resignation, and she was right. Because they had been here before, the Malones felt obliged to inquire about their journey, their health, their newly married state, their feelings on the weather as it had been in the city, and what might be to come here, and then in great detail about the girls, who Jack introduced as their wards. Italian, said the younger Malone. I never would have guessed it. Jack bit back what he might have said. Imagine our surprise to get Italian orphans who aren't filthy and diseased. Because he saw the confusion on the man's face, his inability to reconcile the little girls he saw before him with what he had heard and read about Italian immigrant hordes ruining the country. It was Anna's hand on his arm that made him pull himself together and end the conversation with a curt nod. One of the things the Malones didn't ask, to Jack's relief, was their destination. When they finally climbed into the little rig, with the four of them squeezed together in on one seat, he set the placid old piebald mare off at a quick trot. Anna, busy with the girls, didn't look up at him until they were on the road north toward Mount Loretto, and Jack was glad. She hadn't seen the odd pale rectangle on the side of a building where a sign had been taken down, but Jack remembered it. Amon Mullen, General Blacksmithing, Horseshoeing, Plow, and Woodwork. Maybe the sign was being repainted, he told himself. Maybe Mullen had moved his business to a bigger space somewhere else in Tottenville. And maybe, he had to deal with the possibility, what he had interpreted as a turn in their luck was nothing more than the eye of the storm. Something was wrong with Jack. Something other than young Michael Malone's careless insult. Anna saw it in the set of his jaw, in the line of his back. The girls sensed it, too, because they were quiet. They were hardly out of town when Leah climbed into Anna's lap, not looking forward, but pressing her face to Anna's shoulder. Then he pulled to the side of the road under a stand of oak trees and tried to smile. I need a minute. Jack secured the reins and jumped down, trotting back the way they had come to disappear behind a stand of bushes. The girls seemed almost to relax, assuming, as most people would, that Jack's distracted mood and sudden leaving had to do with nature's call. But Anna knew somehow that it was something else entirely. He had walked off to gather his thoughts and his courage, because he knew something, had heard or seen something that she had not. She wanted to go talk to him, but the girls would be terrified to be left alone, even for a few moments, in this strange landscape of fields and pastures and orchards, with so much at stake just a few minutes away. For years, she had trained to be able to make fast decisions in difficult situations. With a scalpel in her hand, some part of her mind took over, made decisions, and acted. But this was foreign to her, this kind of need, and she was at a loss. Jack climbed back up onto the seat and took up the reins. He hesitated for a long moment, and then he turned to the girls. He said, "I have a feeling that the family we're going to see isn't going to be there, that they've gone away. I want you to be prepared for that possibility, both of you. Once we know whether I'm right, we can talk about what to do next." It took considerable effort, but Anna held her questions back. When they turned onto the narrow lane that would take them to the little house near the beach, her stomach gave a lurch and climbed into her throat. The girls looked stunned, like children who have passed beyond fear to a protective numbness. In the first few seconds, it seemed that Jack had been wrong. The house wasn't deserted. The front door stood ajar, and the sound of someone chopping wood came from somewhere behind it. Jack looked at Rosa and then at Leah, his expression not exactly grave, but solemn. He said, "Wait here. Mind me now, you need to wait here." Then he squeezed Anna's hand and was gone. When Jack joined the police department, one of the first and hardest lessons, one that he still struggled with, was something obvious. In his case, at least, anger was far harder to manage than a gun. As he walked toward the front door of the cottage, he reminded himself that he was not here as a police officer. He had no right to ask questions, much less demand answers. That thought was still in his mind when a woman came to the door. Two facts presented themselves immediately. This small, dark-haired woman was close to giving birth, her hands were folded across the great expanse of her belly, and she was not Mrs. Mullen. Jack took off his hat and inclined his head politely. "Ma'am," he said, "we're looking for the Mullen family. Have I got the right house?" It was the right house, without question. But the Mullen family had moved away. In her uncertain English, the lady of the house explained to him that her husband had bought the house and the business from Mr. Mullen, who had moved away a week ago with his family.
"I don't know where they went," she said, and seemed to be searching for words. "Would you like to come in, you and your family?"
She stepped back and opened the door in a welcoming gesture. Behind him, Jack heard a scuffle and Rosa's voice raised in protest. He did not want to bother these people, but he could see no other way to convince Rosa of the truth. As she arrived at his side, breathless, trembling, he said, "Rosa, this lady has invited us in to talk for a few minutes."
In Italian, he added,
"If you can't mind your manners, you'll have to wait outside." The truculent look on her face did not escape him. Magda and István Szabó were Hungarian immigrants who had come to the States 5 years earlier and finally saved enough money to buy a place of their own. With Leah on her lap, Anna spoke to Mr. Szabó, who had come in to talk with them because his English was very good. His gaze kept shifting to Rosa, who stood stiffly by the door with Jack. It was obvious that nothing but the truth would do in this situation. She said,
Mr. Sabo, I realize this is very odd, but if I could just explain.
Drawing on all the skills honed in years of recounting patient histories during rounds, she told the story of the four Russo children, how they had come to Manhattan, and the loss of the boys. He held up a hand only when he wanted her to pause long enough so he could translate for his wife.
Anna fixed her gaze on Mrs. Sabo. She had a kind face and an open expression, where her husband was more reserved.
We believe that the Mullins adopted Vittorio, Anna finished, and his sisters want so much to see him, we couldn't keep the truth from them any longer.
The Sabos were talking, a hushed conversation that was impossible to interpret. Anna was paying such close attention that Leah had slipped from her lap before she realized what was happening. She walked toward Mrs. Sabo, her eyes as big as silver dollars.
May I see my brother? He's so little.
A small, sharp hiccup escaped her.
Devi avere molto paura.
Rosa spoke up, her voice strained.
She says he must be very afraid.
The room was suddenly so still that Anna could hear the far-off crash of waves on the beach. In the quiet, Rosa came forward and put an arm around her sister. They looked so much alike, and were so different in the way they saw the world. She wondered if Rosa might have been a child more like her sister if circumstance hadn't demanded the impossible of her. Mrs. Sabo was clearly moved by the two girls. She looked very near to tears.
I am very sorry, but I don't know your brother. I saw him once, a very beautiful boy, a happy boy, but he moved away with his...
She looked to her husband.
Azuichaladya.
His new family, he supplied.
Yes, his new family. We don't know where they went. I'm very sorry that we can't help you, but maybe...
Rosa's head came up sharply.
Maybe if you talk to the priest.
Father McKinaway? Jack asked.
Yes, Father McKinaway, she said, at Mount Loreto. Maybe he can help you.
As they came over the hillside to see the mission spread out before them, it seemed to Anna that quite a lot of progress had been made since their last visit. On the day they got married, she reminded herself. Only one of the buildings looked to be finished, its chimney putting out a long, dark streak of smoke. The two largest buildings were far from finished, but today there was no sign of monks or workmen of any kind. She wondered if they had run out of supplies or volunteers or both. It would be many months before any boys could be made at home here, and she really could not work up any interest. She would always associate this place with Vittorio's loss, because he was lost. They went to see the priest because Rosa must see this through, but in Anna's mind there was no doubt. Vittorio would live his life as Timothy Mullen. She wished him happy and well. Anna met Jack's eye over the girls' heads and understood that he had most probably reached the same conclusions she had come to. There would be time enough to talk about it, once they were back home again. What she had to do now was prepare herself for Father McKinaway. She had to keep her thoughts to herself, but the girls put question after question to Jack. He answered each question honestly. No, he didn't know when the orphans would be coming to live here. He thought that most of them must be at the mission in the city, and that they would all be boys. Would there be room for girls as well at some point was another question he couldn't answer. He was sure there would be classrooms, and lessons, and chores, and mass, most probably every day. If Vittorio might be here, with the priest. Jack answered without hesitation. Vittorio was gone away with the Mullen family, who loved him and would care for him. Anna wondered what the girls were imagining about the interview to come. If there had ever been opportunity for them to talk to a priest outside of religious services. Because she had spoken to this particular priest. She had told him about these girls who had survived so much, and in turn, he had gone to the Mullins. The letter Anna had written and rewritten had never been mailed. Or, more to the point, it had found a different target. Anna had not been able to explain the whole series of events to herself until Margaret brought out Rosa's exercise book, every page filled to the margins with careful lettering. Rosa had been eager to learn to read, and Margaret had worked with her every day. She was just far enough along that she could work out short, simple sentences. Mornings, she would glare at the newspaper as if it were holding back secrets she was determined to discover. She would point out words she knew and ask about others. And she did the work Margaret assigned her, and more every day. One of her favorite things to do was to write out her own name, along with the names of all her family, father and mother and sister and both brothers. "She's very diligent," Margaret said. "You see, she filled this notebook in a week. I said she could use scrap paper from the bins until I had time to get her another one. I should have been more careful, but it never occurred to me." "You're not at fault," Anna said, "and neither is she. It's not the best way to resolve the situation, but it's done now. We'll have to make the best of it."
"I'm afraid I indulge her,"
Margaret went on anyway. Jack shook his head at her.
"She's curious. She wants to learn. It's not a matter of giving her more sweets than are good for her. I think the girls are fortunate that you have so much time to spend with them."
It was one of the kindest things Anna had ever heard him say, and it made her ashamed to have been so dismissive of Margaret. And now here they were, about to confront Father McKinaway. When Anna thought of him, she saw the unapologetic dislike and disdain he felt for her. He had warned her not to test him, and that had not been an empty threat. He came out to greet them before Jack had brought the rig to a stop. Anna's expression was grim, but the priest smiled broadly at her, his cheeks puffing up like pink pillows.
"Dr. Savard," he said, all polite good spirits. "How very good to see you again. I thought you might stop by."
For a split second, Jack had the idea that Anna was going to punch the priest in the face as hard as she possibly could. The image was so strong in his mind that he put a hand on her upper arm and felt the flexing of her muscles. He held out his other hand to the priest.
"I'm Jack Mezzanotte, Dr. Savard's husband, and these are our wards, Rosa and Leah Russo."
McKinaway had a firm handshake. He barely glanced at the girls before his gaze shifted back to Jack.
"And you are a doctor, too?"
"He's a police detective."
Rosa spoke up clearly, without hesitation, and with none of the deference Jack would have expected. Anna seemed to have lost her voice entirely, but he could feel her tension, every nerve twanging. McKinaway said,
"An Italian detective."
"Detective Sergeant," Jack said.
One eyebrow shot up, as if this news surprised him. Jack had nothing against priests in general. In his experience, some of them were harmless. Some meant to do good things, but did just the opposite. A few managed to help, and even fewer took joy in raising hell out of bloody-mindedness, contempt for the world, and ego. He would have guessed McKinaway to be one of the better sort. Given the amount of work that was going into putting together the refuge for orphans, but he saw now he had been mistaken. McKinaway worked for the most vulnerable children, selflessly, endlessly. But at the same time, he was close-fisted, resentful, and protective of what he considered his own. Most of all, he didn't like women, and wanted nothing to do with them.
Anna's coming to his office had not won his cooperation. Just the opposite. He wanted her to know that she had been foolish to try to outwit him. The Russo boys were not the point, as far as he was concerned. Anna was saying, "You told me that you would be glad to talk to Vittorio Russo's sisters, and here they are." There was a jerking at the corner of his mouth.
"Dr. Savard, did I not tell you that I have no knowledge of the Vittorio Russo you're looking for? I'm sorry I can't be of any help. Girls, the best you can do is to pray for your brother's soul. He was baptized, I'm sure, and so you can think of him in heaven with your parents."
Leah's mouth hung open, but Jack doubted she would have been able to produce a single word. Rosa stepped a little in front of her sister and said,
"Yes, he was baptized, but he's not in heaven. He went away with a family."
She looked over her shoulder, as if she could see the house where the Mullins had lived.
"And you know where he is, don't you?"
The complacent smile froze for the briefest moment, and then McKinaway's gaze focused not on Anna, but Jack.
"In my experience, Italian children are polite and respectful to their priests. I would have expected better." "All right," Jack said, working hard to keep his tone neutral. "That's enough. Anna, please take the girls for a walk. I need a half hour here, and then we'll be on our way."
Rosa looked at him with a calm acceptance that he found harder to bear than tears would have been. In Italian, she said,
"He doesn't care. He won't help."
She walked away beside Anna without looking back. Chapter 38. Elise fell asleep while waiting for Anna and Jack to get back from Staten Island, and woke Sunday to a drizzling rain. The girls were in the hall talking to Margaret and Mrs. Lee. Rosa's tone was matter of fact.
"I'm not going to church. Not until my brothers are found, and maybe not then. Tonino keeps asking me in my dreams why we are staying away, and I tell him about that priest who stole Vittorio."
Elise drew in a surprised breath and held it so as to hear what came next.
"But Leah can go if she likes," Rosa said.
"No," Leah said. "I won't go too."
"You won't go either," Margaret corrected.
"That too, either,"
said Leah.
"Well then," Mrs. Lee said, all business, "that's not a little thing, but we'll talk about it later today. We'll be off, Mr. Lee and me. You girls get the table set for Sunday dinner before we get back, and no peeking at the roast. We don't need any more burnt fingers."
Leah said,
"Can I go over to Weeds to play with Skidder?"
"Not until you've had your breakfast," Margaret said. "Let's go do that now." With that, Elise realized the time. She was running very late and would have to skip breakfast and hearing about Staten Island, too. Whatever had happened yesterday had not paralyzed the girls with anger or sorrow, and that would have to be enough for the moment. As she half-trotted, half-walked to the hospital, juggling an open umbrella, her satchel, and the banana Mrs. Quinlan had pressed into her hand in lieu of a proper breakfast, she thought back to herself at Rosa's age, and what would have happened if she had announced she was leaving the church. Her mothers and aunts would have laughed at such an announcement. If she had persisted, there would have been more serious repercussions that had to do with the paddle that hung on the pantry wall. And after that, the confessional to start. She would have had to explain herself to Father La Montagna. The idea was odd enough to make her smile. Father La Montagna had been a sweet old man who had lived a long and difficult life. He would have listened patiently, and then changed her mind for her in the gentlest but most persistent way. Not that leaving the church would have ever occurred to her to start with. She liked going to Mass. The church itself felt like an extension of home. Now, Rosa had announced, What? A rejection of the church, or God, or both?
Somehow she couldn't imagine Mrs. Quinlan or anyone else in the household of free thinkers taking exception. They would ask questions, certainly, but disapproval seemed as unlikely as a whipping.
On the short walk to the hospital, Elise passed four different churches: Presbyterian, Baptist, Dutch Reformed, Episcopal, and right next to the New Amsterdam, St. Mark's. She knew where to find a friend's meeting house, and not far from there, Scotch Presbyterian, Lutheran, and a Jewish synagogue. There were at least 15 different Catholic parishes in the city, each with church and chapel, rectory, convent, and often a school as well. New York was crowded with places to worship. But in the house on Waverly Place, only the Lees and Margaret went to church with any regularity, and not to the same church either. The biggest surprise thus far, and she must believe there were more to come, was that Bambina and Celestina went to temple once a month or so. Every other Italian Elise had ever known or heard about was Catholic as the Pope. But half the mezzanotes were Jewish, while others seemed to be nothing at all. She should have been shocked and worried about her own immortal soul in this hotbed of cheerful heretics. A year ago, she likely would have had just that reaction. Now nothing seemed so simple. She had no basis on which to make judgments about the mezzanotes. She hoped they would do as much for her. At 5:30, Jack slipped out of bed, grabbed his clothes, and dressed in the hall, determined to let Anna sleep on. Despite a long day of traveling in damp clothes while dealing with distraught children, she had had a restless night. It was after 3 when she finally slipped into a deep sleep. He knew because he hadn't slept well himself, aware of every chime of the mantel clock from the parlor. John McKinaway had robbed them both of a peaceful night's sleep, and Jack was sure there would be more such nights. Then at 6 in the morning, a runner from Mulberry Street had knocked on the door with a message. The chief was calling a meeting at 7 about the Campbell and associated cases. Associated cases. They were in for it now. 4 detectives and 2 patrolmen were gathered in Chief Baker's office, including Oscar and himself. Jack counted 4 case files spread out on the table and knew the names on the labels without looking. Janine Campbell, Abigail Liljestrom, Eula Schmidt, and Irina Svetlova. More folders sat in a pile in front of Oscar, the looks of which filled Jack with dread.
"I've got 3 more likelies and 1 possible," Oscar was saying.
One by one, he went over the cases that fit the profile, all of them ferreted out of death certificates going back 6 months. Mariella Luna, Esther Fromm, Jenny House, and 1 uncertain case, a Jane Doe. All of them had died of peritonitis following an illegal abortion, and all of them had died hard. The 3 who had been identified were married to successful men with substantial incomes. They had well-appointed homes, servants, abundant and expensive wardrobes, and somewhere between 2 and 6 healthy, well-cared-for children. They were all between 25 and 35 years old. Jenny House had died at her home on Gramercy Park. Esther Fromm and Mariella Luna, both from out of town, had died in rooms at the Astor and Grand Union hotels. Jane Doe had been dead on arrival at Women's Hospital. Baker said,
"We'll need new postmortems on all of them. Sainsbury, get going on the exhumations. I want shovels in the ground no later than noon. Maroney, do you have a forensic specialist in mind? Nicholas Lambert at Bellevue, if he's willing. That will save some time, as he did the Liljestrom autopsy, and we won't have to bring the remains back from Buffalo. And he's good. Go talk to him today. We have to get moving on this before the newspapers pick it up. Larkin, what about the letter?
Michael Larkin was the youngest detective in the room, but he was not looking his age. His eyes were red-rimmed and bloodshot, his skin mottled and doughy. The thing was, he might be fighting a hangover complete with sour stomach and a headache, but his voice and hands were steady. It was nearly impossible to knock a Larkin down, even harder to keep him there.
I've got a draft.
He slid a piece of paper down the table toward Baker, who took it up and held it at arm's length to read. In 10 seconds flat, he was scowling at the man who had written it.
Christ on the bloody cross, Larkin. Do you know any lady who talks like this?
He cleared his throat and read.
I write to you in utter despair, a foolish girl taken in by the promises of a rake. Reading penny dreadfuls in your time off, Larkin.
Oscar handed Baker another piece of paper.
Maybe this will work.
This time the captain read aloud from the start.
Regard to your advertisement, if your medical practice, hygienic, modern, prepared to pay a premium, respond with particulars.
He grunted.
That's more like it. Larkin, get it postmarked first thing tomorrow and into the right post office box. Then set up a rotation to stake out the lobby. I want to hear from you every couple hours.
Turning the rig north on 2nd Avenue toward Bellevue, Jack said,
I could have used you yesterday, talking to that priest.
Oscar had been brought up Catholic, and still went to Mass when he was sober enough on a Sunday morning. He had no illusions about priests, and was generally hard to shock, but he frowned when Jack told him about the Mullins and McKinaway.
I don't know what I was expecting, Jack said, but it didn't occur to me that he could make the whole family disappear like a magician's rabbit into a hat.
The muscles in Oscar's jaw began to tick and roll, but his tone was even.
A trickster of the First Order, and him not even a Jesuit. I'm sorry for the girls, but it's a miracle you got as close as you did. I don't suppose Rosa sees it that way.
They rode along in silence for a while. Jack glanced at his partner and said,
Leah is calling me uncle and Anna auntie. And Rosa? Don't know if she is even talking to us, Jack said. Remains to be seen.
Anna woke in stages, like a swimmer drifting toward land until the water itself pushed her out into the waking world. 3 things came to her all at once. She was alone in bed in a quiet house, which meant that Jack had left for Mulberry Street without waking her, the rotter. The winds that had battered them all Saturday had subsided, but left behind a hypnotic rain as soft and warm as new milk. And she had a cold. She barely got the handkerchief out from beneath her pillow before she produced a triplet of wet sneezes. After a day of travel and damp clothes, the head cold was no surprise. But it was something of a catastrophe in purely practical terms. Until her symptoms had gone, she could not see patients or even step foot in the hospital. A head cold was not a real threat to an otherwise healthy, well-nourished person, but it could be the end of someone whose health was already compromised. And she hated colds. The fuzziness of mind and head, the impertinence of a body that would not obey simple commands. The oddest thoughts came to her when she had a cold. She hoped the girls had escaped this, and somehow knew that she needn't worry about Jack. Lying in the bed they shared, half asleep, sniffling, she willed him healthy and untouched, while he did whatever detective sergeants did on a Sunday morning. Now she had to get up and talk to the girls. To pretend yesterday was just a bad dream would only make things worse. But it would not be easy. Dressed and armed with 3 fresh handkerchiefs, she made her way through the quiet house toward the kitchen and heard the distinct rhythm of Mrs. Cabot's down east accent.
clipped in some places, R sounds swallowed whole, while in other words were stretched to the breaking point and tacked back together. There was some debate going on about Skidder's breakfast. "Leah, my dear, no honey for Skidder."
"Why?"
Leah, sincerely curious as ever. "Because he's already sweet enough." Anna smiled, imagining the look on Leah's face as she puzzled this through. Then she got right to the crux of the matter.
"Am I sweet enough?"
"You are mighty sweet, but maybe you could do with a little more honey. Wipe your nose, dear, but on your hanky." The girl sneezed, one after the other. Anna supposed it was inevitable. Mrs. Cabot was saying, "Now, what were you telling me about that priest fellow on the island?"
Rosa said, "I don't want to talk about him."
"I do," said Leah, sniffing. "He has a red face and white hair, and he smiles a lot, but he's mean. He didn't like us. He wouldn't tell us where he hid our little brother."
Anna opened the door, and all three of them turned toward her. Leah's thoughtful expression gave away to something else, comfort or relief or some combination of the two. Anna's throat constricted, but she forced herself to breathe and then to smile. Rosa's expression was far more solemn, but yesterday's open hostility was gone. "Welcome to my infirmary," Mrs. Cabot said. "Dr. Savard, your nose is as red as a lobster."
"Lobster,"
Leah echoed and sneezed. "Sit down. I've got dry toast and my special fever tea with honey and lemon." It took some time to negotiate breakfast. Anna gave up on the idea of coffee in the face of Mrs. Cabot's stern disapproval. But in the end, she sat across from the girls with a cup of tea in her hands and a plate of dry toast between them. She had wanted Jack here for this conversation, but now it seemed that this was the better way. It was something she needed to do on her own, without worry about what he was hearing or what he thought about it.
"We should talk about Vittorio," she said, "and about Tonino, too, and your parents. We have to tell stories about the people we love who go away. It's the best way to hold on to them. Don't you think, Mrs. Cabot?"
"Aya," Mrs. Cabot said with a quiet smile. "No better way."
"You don't talk about your people," Rosa said. "Auntie Margaret says you never do."
"I didn't, that's true. But I think it was a mistake not to. We should tell the stories and then write them down."
"I don't know where to start," Leah said.
"We can take turns," Anna said. "I'll tell you first about the summer I was 3 years old, when my parents died."
"There is too little to remember," Rosa said with a certain disdain.
"It is too little," Anna agreed. "And I can't say what I really remember and what I only remember because Aunt Quinlan told me the story. But I remember how I felt, and that's the important part."
Her voice was calm and without tremor, but Leah got up from playing with Skidder to crawl into her lap. With the little girl's solid weight in her arms, Anna sent herself back to the summer when everything changed. Dr. Lambert was in the middle of a post-mortem when they got to Bellevue, so they went outside to wait in air that smelled of recent rain and the sea. Jack had almost gotten used to the smells that clung to Anna's clothes when she came home from the New Amsterdam, strong soap and carbolic, denatured alcohol, all with an undercurrent of blood and bile. Bellevue had all that times 10, because they took anyone who came to them, men and women and children, the sickest and poorest and least likely to survive, the outdoor poor. Outside, leaning against a wall warmed by the sun, Jack watched as people came and went out a side entrance favored by staff. A crowd of younger men, students or interns, appeared, looking like a company of soldiers fresh from the battlefield.
Jack caught sight of a familiar face, just as Oscar saw him too.
Dr. Graham!
Neil Graham's head jerked around toward them, his expression less than friendly.
He doesn't recognize us, Jack said. Sure he does. Look at him trying to make a pretty face. He may just manage it by the time he gets over here.
Jack studied the younger man, seeing exhaustion and irritation. Medical students worked impossible hours for little pay. In the same situation, Jack knew that he would be less than sociable. He could tolerate a bad mood, but there was something sour in Graham's expression.
Detective sergeants.
Graham stood in front of them but left his hands in the pockets of his very grimy tunic and rocked back on his heels.
I don't think you want to be shaking my hand today. Not until I've soaked it in carbolic for a couple hours. Hard shift?
Oscar asked. He blew out a breath.
Long. 48 hours and maybe 2 hours sleep. Only 2 surgeries I was allowed in on because, in case you didn't know, this place,
he jerked his chin toward the hospital,
is staffed to the roof with students who can buy preference. Today there was a cesarean, only 3 done last year in the whole city. But instead of that, I was stuck dealing with the usual garbage that comes through this place. People who don't have the sense God gave an ant. Real deviants.
Oscar said,
that bad? Did you lose a patient? No. The work stinks, but I could handle it with my eyes closed. Some of the patients would be better off dead, to my way of thinking. You two know what it's like dealing with whores.
You couldn't be a cop and take offense at plain speech. Not if you wanted to get anything done. Conversation in the station house was often far worse. But there was something in the way Graham used the word whore with a lip-curling disgust. He was saying,
I'll be glad to see the last of this place.
He turned his head to scan the hospital windows.
You headed someplace else?
Oscar's tone was light, friendly, encouraging.
There's a surgery position opening up at women's. That place is like a palace compared to this cesspool.
Oscar said.
Competition must be stiff.
Graham's whole face contorted.
That doesn't worry me. You know, I've got twice as many hours in the operating room as anybody else who's applying. They know what I'm worth at women's. Somebody from the staff, I won't name names, told me. He said I had a brilliant career ahead of me. Women's is my next stop. And then, who knows? London, Paris, Rome.
His smile broadened, full of satisfaction.
And no poor people at women's,
Jack observed.
They've got a charity ward, Graham said, a little insulted. But there are only so many beds. And that means you can pick and choose among the ones who come begging and only take the interesting cases. This place.
He glanced up at the hospital.
The scum of the earth. And still you managed to get good training,
Oscar said. Graham shot him a suspicious look, but relaxed when he saw nothing but mild curiosity in Oscar's expression.
There's work enough. But I hate having my time wasted on the cases that come in here. Truth be told, I don't much like examining any woman. Any honest surgeon will tell you that. But with whores, it's like rooting around in a bucket of filth, up to the wrist in sludge. The last one I saw today, she looked 40, but I doubt she was more than 20. The worst case of clap I've ever seen, and she was still working, still spreading her legs for coin. Imagine the degenerate who would pay for the privilege.
Huh, Jack said.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you'll be examining females at women's hospital, too.
He jerked a shoulder.
They won't be crawling with lice and crabs. It's the best place in the country, maybe in the world, for the kind of surgery that interests me. The only thing that interests me. And mostly I'll be operating anyway. And doing research. Some of the most important advances in the field come out of women's.
I've got a few ideas. You never know. I may end up revolutionizing surgery.
Jack said.
Sounds like you've got your career planned.
Graham gave a soft laugh, his mouth working like a twist of gristle.
There's always room at the top, as my mother used to say. I put in 48 hours here without sleep, easy as falling off a log.
His head swung toward Jack, and the expression he normally wore, alert, sharply observant, constrained by respect and convention, was back in place.
So, what brings the best of the New York Police Department detective squad to Bellevue on a damp Sunday morning?
Oscar produced his widest, least sincere smile.
Ask me no questions, and I'll tell you no lies. Not another case like the Campbell woman. Why would you think that?
Jack said. He shrugged.
Can't think of much other than murder that would bring you up here. It's not like you have room in the jails for all the rutting drunkards we see here. Inbred idiots.
Graham hesitated, waited for some kind of response, and then cleared his throat.
Nice seeing you again. I've got some sleeping to catch up on.
Give Mrs. Jennings our regards,
Oscar said. Neil Graham studied Oscar for a moment, nodded, and walked away. On the way to Nicholas Lambert's office, Oscar said,
The little shit. And there he's been under our noses the whole time.
Jack was thinking the same thing.
He made my skin crawl. You like him for the Campbell case, then? To my mind, it was as good as a confession. There's still the pesky matter of evidence.
Oscar shrugged that fact away.
He hates women, hates examining them, but he wants to spend a career cutting them open. He's a braggart of the first order, the kind who thinks he can do anything. To listen to him, there was never a more talented doctor put on earth, and everybody recognizes him for a genius, except when they're duping him out of surgeries that should be his. He can work 2 days without a nap, and he's put out that he couldn't get more than 2 hours last night. He can't keep track of his lies. And don't forget, Jack, my boy. He assisted in the emergency surgery on Janine Campbell. He works an ambulance a couple of days a week. That's worth looking into, at least.
Jack remembered Anna talking about that at the inquest. And he remembered the way Campbell had described her when he testified, in sober but complimentary terms. Now he wondered if that had all been an act.
If it was him who did Campbell, he found an unusual way to return to the scene of the crime without raising suspicions,
Jack said.
We should have thought of it, Oscar said. Mrs. Stone wasn't in the bedroom when he went in to examine Janine Campbell. Maybe she recognized him, but we'll never know now. And who but a surgeon can take a knife to a woman, do his worst, and get away with it?
He was sizing us up, Jack said.
We'll have to be careful not to scare him off. He could disappear and start all over someplace else.
Oh, no, Oscar said. I'm not having that. I won't be happy until he steps on that trap door and falls straight into Satan's loving arms.
As they headed downstairs to Lambert's office, it was like walking through an invisible curtain into a swamp. The air both cooler and almost dense enough to eat.
Neil Graham, Oscar muttered, putting his hands on women.
He shook his head in disgust. Nicholas Lambert was a wiry, athletic 50-year-old with a full head of dark hair and a short-cropped beard to match. In stark contrast, his complexion was very pale and as fine as a child's. Like Anna's, his hands were red and swollen.
More than one good surgeon had given up practice because of dermatitis,
Lambert said with the slightest trace of an accent. He had been aware of Jack's study of his hands, but he hadn't taken offense.
An unfortunate but unavoidable side effect of the antiseptic method, Oscar huffed, surprised.
Why antiseptic when you're cutting on the dead? What harm can you do?
That's not the issue, Lambert said. Some diseases outlast death. The microorganisms that cause smallpox, for example.
A dead man can give you smallpox.
Or cholera or hepatitis. Other diseases, too. The antiseptic methods are the first line of defense, and that's why my hands look like boiled crabs. The odd thing is I grew up on a dairy farm, and my father and brothers have hands that look only slightly more swollen and red than mine.
My wife has the same problem, Jack said.
Lambert paused, a lifted brow indicating curiosity but an unwillingness to ask intrusive questions. Maroney hooked a thumb in Jack's direction.
He married Anna Savard of the New Amsterdam.
Ah, Lambert smiled, started to speak and stopped, started again and cleared his throat.
Congratulations. Best wishes.
Jack nodded.
You haven't found a way around the dermatitis?
50 years ago, they were experimenting with gloves made of sheep's cecum in Germany, but nothing came of that. Now, with the vulcanization of rubber, things might move more quickly. Dr. Savard's hands are sensitive to carbolic, I take it. Before you leave, remind me to give you something for her to try. But I don't think you've come here to talk about dermatitis.
Jack said, you did the Liljestrom postmortem. Did you read about the Campbell case in the papers?
Lambert leaned back, half sitting on the edge of his desk, his arms folded.
I did, and I wondered about the similarities. You've got more cases like those two? More than a few, maybe, Oscar said. But we need a forensic specialist to look at all the bodies. We were hoping you might be willing to repeat postmortems on all of them, and right away, as soon as we can get them exhumed.
Lambert bent over slightly, as if to study his shoes. When he looked up again, his expression was somber.
It's hard to imagine a lot of women dying like that. What we're hoping, Jack said, is to keep it from happening again.
Lambert nodded.
I'll talk to the director and get permission. How much can I tell him? Nothing, said Jack, except we've requested your help on some difficult cases. Nothing about any possible connection to the Campbell or Liljestrom deaths. Who suggested me, if I might ask?
Oscar shifted uncomfortably, but Jack liked the question, and the man who had thought to ask it.
Anna, she considers you the best forensic specialist in the city. Very good of her. But if these cases are connected, you'll want an alienist to go over the evidence. A physician who can speak to the mind of the man who would act on such impulses.
Oscar said,
that would be our next step, after the postmortem reports. Can you start right away?
It would go faster if I had some assistance. I've got a couple of students who would be glad of the work.
Oscar frowned. Better not to involve anybody else, if it can be avoided.
30 seconds passed by while Lambert continued to study his shoes. When he looked up, Jack saw that he was far too intelligent to be so easily misdirected.
You've got a suspect here, at Bellevue? No suspects yet, Jack said. That's why we're in a hurry. Whoever's behind this, he won't stop until he's made to stop.
I see your point. Most likely I can manage on my own, but if things do get out of hand, could I call on Dr. Savard?
Sure, Jack said. I don't know what she'll say, but you can ask.
At the door, Lambert hesitated.
May I ask a personal question?
Jack tensed a little, but nodded.
Is the other Dr. Savard? Savard Verhoeven, Jack supplied. Thank you. I understand she's gone to Switzerland with her husband. Do you have any word on how Kep is doing? He's stable, Jack said. His spirits are good. Sophie is content.
I think of him often, Lambert said. His father and mine were good friends. We come from the same town in Flanders, and I liked him. If you have the opportunity, please send my regards and best wishes.
On the way back to Mulberry Street, Oscar watched Jack for about 10 seconds too long.
What? You're lucky you got to Anna before he did. He's a doctor, a friend of a close friend. No hair up his ass about women doctors. Polite, intelligent, and he likes her. Did you see the way he smiled when her name came up?
Jack made a sound in his throat that was enough of an answer, even for Oscar. His partner took a cigar from his pocket, bit off the end, and spat it over the side of the rig into the street, grinning the whole time. Elise was in the garden when Jack came through the back gate, and for once, there was no sign of the little girls. "You're the only one who escaped Staten Island without a head cold," she told him. "The girls are confined to their beds for the day, and none too happy about it."
"How does Rosa seem to you?" he asked.
Elise lifted a shoulder. "Some of the fight has gone out of her. It makes life easier, but it's sad, too, to see such resignation in a little girl."
"I'm wondering if she's relieved. Not that she'd admit to it or even recognize it," he said. "But she did something astounding, almost unheard of. If the end result was not what we hoped for, she should be proud of herself."
"She should," Elise agreed, "but she can't right now. She needs time. Did you realize that Anna has been confined to bed, too? Mrs. Cabot has got her boxed in."
"No escape attempts?"
"Not yet, but you'd better hurry." He took off his shoes and went upstairs in his stocking feet, meaning to be thoughtful, but hoping to fail in a small way. And Anna didn't disappoint, calling out as soon as he reached the upstairs hall.
"Mezzanotte," her voice cracked and wobbled. "Stop tiptoeing around and come in here."
At the foot of the bed, he took stock.
"You're losing your voice, and that means for once I have the advantage. I might even win an argument."
Her expression softened, and then she laughed, a soundless huffing.
"Sleep," he said. "We can talk later." "I've been sleeping most of the day. Sit down and tell me about your meeting this morning."
She stared at him until he gave in with a sigh and sat down on the edge of the bed.
"Not so close," she pointed to the chairs by the hearth. "Sit over there."
He dragged the chair closer to the bed, obeying and not obeying. Sitting down, he remembered the tin in his pocket and retrieved it.
"What's that?"
"Nicholas Lambert gave it to me for you, for your hands, for dermatitis."
"Why would you be talking to Nicholas Lambert about my dermatitis? And when was this?"
"Earlier today, because he was talking about his own, and so I mentioned it." She curled her fingers in a hand-it-over gesture, but he shook his head.
"It can wait until you're feeling better." "Don't coddle me. Tell me about this meeting with Lambert. What did you need to talk to him about?" "Oh, wait, it's about the Campbell case, isn't it?" "Is it?"
So he told her. At first, it seemed she hadn't understood him. But the color rose in her cheeks as if she had been slapped or insulted, which Jack supposed she had been. 7 or 8 women, she shook her head. All like Janine Campbell. How are they similar? He gave her what she needed. Described the overlapping circumstances, age and marital status, social standing, childbearing history, autopsy findings.
"He won't have to redo the Campbell or Liljestrom postmortems, but the others he'll start with tomorrow. They've already started on the exhumations."
Anna leaned back against the pillows. "I can't grasp this. I can't believe something like this is really happening. Somewhere nearby, there's a doctor or midwife or...
I don't even know what to call such a person, who kills women because they don't want to have children.
More children, Jack said. All of them already had children.
That's even worse in some ways. A woman who wants to be finished with childbearing has no right to live. Her voice cracked. He picked up a cup, half full, and handed it to her. For once, she drank without wrinkling her nose. Then she let him smooth the sheets and adjust the blankets. All the time, he wondered if he should mention Neil Graham, when he had so little concrete to offer. Something in Graham's tone of voice, the way he turned his head, the curve of his mouth, the connections he made between whore and woman and filth. There was something very wrong with the man, but he would have to keep that to himself for a while longer, until he had more concrete evidence to offer this woman who was a scientist before she was anything else at all. He sat with her while she drifted off to sleep. He was about to get up when she roused. If Janine Campbell was the first, that would mean there was one victim a week for 8 weeks. Did they all happen on the same day of the week? Even in the middle of this god-awful case, she made him smile.
Did you think like a copper before I married you, or has that rubbed off?
There was something almost shy about her smile, as if she wasn't sure this was a compliment, and if it was, whether she had earned it. But she waited for him to answer.
We'll be more able to answer that question once Lambert is finished with the postmortems.
And then he said,
Oscar thinks Lambert likes you. I think he's probably right.
Now her smile shifted to plain disbelief. Don't be silly. He doesn't know me.
Maybe he knows you better than you imagine.
Oh, I see, Anna said, blinking sleepily. This is the argument you think you can win because I'm losing my voice. And you know what? I'll let you have this little victory,
as wrong as you are.
Chapter 39. Without real work to do, unable to read because of a headache, a wash in honey and lemon tea, Anna's mind kept running off to Staten Island. Certain pictures came to mind and wouldn't be banished. The priest's smug expression, satisfied because he had managed to keep the children apart. The way Rosa had stood looking out at the sea, her shoulders rounded in surrender. Leah's wet face and the small hiccups she couldn't control. Their brother was truly gone and out of reach. Rosa had failed to do that one thing her mother had asked of her. They had no hope of finding Vittorio, and still not even a hint about Tonino. And Jack, standing there in the middle of the half-built orphan asylum. In theory, Anna understood that he was capable of violence, and committed violence in the course of his every day. She knew, too, that he was capable of controlling his temper, but she saw what it cost him to keep his anger in check. When they drove away from Mount Loretto, McKinaway was standing just where they left him, his wrists crossed at the small of his back, his expression blank. Sometime, not today, she would ask Jack what he had said to the priest, when she was sure she wanted to know. When she wasn't thinking about Staten Island, it was the story she had told the girls on Sunday morning that plagued her. Now that she had opened that door, it wouldn't be closed again so easily. During the day, she drifted in and out of memories distorted by time and sorrow. She wondered now if her memory was faulty, or if she had managed to really tell the story, to be factual and even blunt. She somehow managed to tell the truth, but not the whole truth. With Jack, she would have to say out loud those things she had kept locked up inside her for more than 20 years. The terrible things she had never spoken aloud, not to her aunt or Sophie, or even with much clarity or precision to herself. Mrs. Cabot fed Anna broth.